Athletes love pushing their limits, but intense training can cause serious imbalances. This is exactly what happened to me. My name is Christopher Kelly. When I first entered the world of competitive mountain biking, I became plagued by numerous chronic health issues. So I changed my diet, and I identified my key imbalances with advanced biomedical testing. Before long, I was feeling and competing better than ever. Now, I'm helping other athletes do the same. Welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly and today I'm joined once again by Dr. Simon Marshall. Hi, Simon.
Hey, Chris. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Actually, no, it's not always a pleasure. Mostly it's a pleasure.
All right, we'll cut that bit out. Like. You know, last time we spoke, Simon, I didn't properly introduce you. So I thought that this time I would do the right thing and read your bio because it is quite impressive and quite funny also. So Dr. Simon Marshall trains the brains of endurance athletes and fitness enthusiasts to become happier and more mentally tough. He is a former professor of family and preventative medicine at the University of California, San Diego, and professor of exercise science at San Diego State University, where he was the director of the graduate program in sport and exercise psychology. He has published over 100 scientific articles on the psychology of exercise and has been cited in the scientific literature over 10,000 times. That's pretty amazing to be cited. There's so much work that gets published now that never gets cited even once. So that is quite incredible. I'll go on. He served as an invited expert on exercise science for the National Institutes of Health, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the American Cancer Society. He is currently the performance psychologist for the BMC Racing Team, an elite world tour professional cycling team. As the husband Sherpa of professional triathlete Leslie Patterson, he is the founding member of Team SHIT, Supportive Husbands in Training, and competes in triathlon or cycling events as the husband of Leslie Patterson. That's very impressive, Simon. Congratulations.
Yeah, well, if you've been in academia, you know, we could talk ad nauseum about the problems with scientific citations and that stuff. But where the rubber hits the road for me is certainly competing, coming across the line and not being told Simon Marshall's finishing, but the husband of Leslie Patterson's finishing. So I've kind of had my identity removed when I actually try and do this stuff myself.
It's your fault for marrying such an amazing woman.
Am I allowed to tell stories occasionally?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You must tell stories because that's the only way we remember things.
Oh, it's all right. So I was in a local sprint triathlon a few years ago and Leslie wasn't racing. And she said, when you get on the run, I'll get on my bike and I'll just pedal near you and just give you some technique cues and motivation, whatever, whatever. So, okay. So I'm on the run and I'm suitably sort of fatigued, not exactly enjoying myself, but it was a good day out anyway. And then I passed this runner and the runner passed me and they say, hey, did you know you've got Leslie Patterson following you on a bike? Did you know that? I'm like, for God's sake, can you tell her to piss off? And they're like, but that's Leslie Patterson. I mean, why is she following you? I didn't tell them that she's my other half and she was just kind of having a good moan at me. But I get this frequently, you know, it's just sort of I'm suddenly rendered inert.
I'm sorry and quite pleased and amused at the same time.
Well, and actually to be in Team Shit, which is quite a growing organization now, we've got like 15 members. You have to have your partner, in this case, not only heterosexual couples, we just inducted our first lesbian husband into our group, but for most part, your wife has to be faster than you, objectively, so not subjectively. And then you have to spend much of your time sherpering. And there's quite a lot of us, you know, in this little club. So it's quite a fun club. So Team Shit, we get our shit together.
Is Leslie really faster than you on a bike, objectively? I'm actually quite surprised by that. If you were to go on a flat time trial, would she beat you?
I love your doubt, Chris. Well, on a flat, short, I'm narrowing down the ways that I can beat her. But I can probably out-muscle when it's pure muscle mass and pure power I can. But for most riding is not like that. Or when those parts of the roads do come up, the parts that have led to that have been so torturous for me that I'm no longer around to be able to use that skill. So, yeah, she's faster than me.
Okay, I bet she climbs like a monkey. I can only imagine how she goes up the trail.
She does. Her power-to-weight ratio is quite phenomenal. And I love it. There's a lot of guys who really don't like getting chicked, you know, past. And I've never understood that. Not just from the obvious hilarity because their ego is so fragile, but I think partly because you're getting passed by someone who undoubtedly spends more time training, is fitter, more talented than you. So fucking get used to it. Love it. Enjoy the fact that you're having a chance to watch someone be better and faster than you. I love it.
You and Leslie are, of course, the authors of The Brave Athlete, which I've been very much enjoying the Audible version of. And you made the decision, very wisely, I think, to narrate the book for yourselves. Can you tell us a little bit about that process? Is as fun as I'm having listening to it?
Well, it's interesting because generally publishers, they caution against authors narrating their own work. We didn't know this, of course. We just thought, well, we want to. And then, well, you really need voice talent. And there's a whole host of reasons why, from the sort of the obvious to that you're so connected to the material and blah, to the fact that you may not have a voice that's meant to be aired, as well as like dysfunctions of the structure of your mouth that creates noise and so on. But we decided to do it and we recorded one alternate chapters. It was really fun, actually. It went quite quick. It was nice to read the stuff that you've written. You realize that when you write a book, you never intend it to be spoken out loud because you're reading in your own head. So actually the art of reading a book is quite awkward in the sense that, oh my God, it's overwritten and you've got all these weird compound sentences and run-ons. But when you actually read it in your head, it's fine. But when you start to say it out loud, it does feel a bit kind of weird occasionally. But yeah, we're glad we did it. And when we first heard like the first couple of chapters and we waited with that bated breath to see what we would sound like, and Leslie was quite animated and had a lot more sort of variations in her tempo. But I just feel as though I sound so fucking boring, which is I was a bit miffed about, because when you're doing it, you think, oh, I'm putting emphasis on this, and because you remember the parts that you were writing and this. And then when you read it, you're so concerned about effing mouth noise and all the other stuff that the technician is whispering in your ear, but what to do and what not to do, that you end up being a little bit too clinical. But it was a fun experience.
Did you actually have to go to a studio to record it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We're not some two-bit outfit here, you know, Chris. What are you talking about? Yeah, we recorded it in our basement on an iPhone. Yeah, we went to a recording studio in Los Angeles and recorded it. And we were each in there, you know, and it takes about 4 days of recording all day. So we'd split the day. I'd do mornings and Leslie would do afternoons or something. But you're still going at it full time.
Wow. I'm grateful for it. I've just been saying that I've been walking on the beach listening to the book. It's like you're there, like coaching me right there in person, which is something that you can't get from a book, right?
Well, I wanted to put a few Easter eggs in there and just start ad-libbing a little bit mid-sentence. They're so strict on how you stick to the text.
Oh, wow.
I think the rules for the technicians have, because you used to have a contracted narrator's voice talent, that you have to stay authentic to what was written. But we fucking wrote it. So we were trying to say, yeah, but can I just add this? And if you've got to this place, you're doing well, because I don't... Oh, no, you have to stick to the script. So.
That's amazing. I was hoping that you would help me debug some stuff that I've been having going on during cross racing. So, okay, so to give you a little bit of background, I'm hoping that by asking you these questions, this is going to help some people listening and that this is not just a free consultation and this is the first time you've ever heard such a thing. I'm pretty sure it's not. Okay, so what's been going on this season, cross season? I said that I wasn't going to race cross because I was in no shape to race it. I was away for 6 or 7 weeks without riding at all. And so I basically didn't train at all. And then I turned up to the first race. I raced the age group, not the elite race. So I wanted to bolster my confidence a little bit. So I raced the age group and I won it easily, just rode off the front, never to be seen again. And that was partly to do with the course and the bike that I was riding and all that. But anyway, I won it and I thought, oh, actually, this is kind of fun. Maybe I should do a few more cross races. And I've done two more since then and I've come third in both races. And I realize what's happening and has happened to me quite a lot in the past is I get to a point, maybe 1 or 2 laps to go, and then I settle for third. Somewhere in my head, it may not be the professor brain that you talk about in The Brave Athlete. It may be the chimp that's settling for third here. I don't feel like I'm making a conscious decision. But a move will go, you know, 2 laps to go. And I know that if I don't go with the two guys in front, I'll never be seen again. Like the chances of me coming back are almost zero. And I have to go. And yet I let them go. Why do I let them go? Like that's so stupid. I've come this far, raced the entire race, and now I'm just going to settle for third. So I guess my first question should be, does this ever come up before?
It's actually surprisingly common. Yeah. In fact, I think it's not just unique to you. I think it's probably an artifact of just the state that we're in, most of us are in at that point of a race, right? And yeah, lots of athletes, they often talk about they throw in the towel. And when we think of throwing in the towel, a lot of athletes think, well, I never sort of stop racing or just pull out. I just kind of soft pedal a bit, or I don't push as hard as I could do. And you'd never know it if you're looking. You're just looking at someone is not making any progress or moving backwards. But the athlete knows this. And afterwards, that's what causes, if I could sort of put about all the top three things that give athletes the most angst in their post-race autopsy, that would be in there. Because it isn't that, oh, I missed a podium by 5 seconds or 3 seconds, or I lost out in the sprint. Or it's the fact that they, at some point, they sort of just wimped out a bit and gave up and settled, and then just either coasted in or just sort of didn't want to hurt anymore. It is surprisingly common. And I wish I had sort of a nice silver bullet succinct answer for why you do that. I can certainly talk to some of the observations that I've had or the commonalities in the athletes who describe that they do that. And then also some of the things that I think may be going on. But the first point is that context matters, right? So if you're in third and the two guys have gone away, and it depends on what intensity you've been racing at, or whether you're totally done or you're bonking, or you think what your perceptions are of the ability of those two other athletes. So a lot of that stuff does matter, because if you're feeling fresh and you know that you can beat them, then it might be a completely different outcome. But if you've sort of been bullied in your own head into thinking, well, I probably wouldn't be able to win this anyway, and so there, what's the point putting all that effort in to probably come third in a sprint or whatever? So talk to me maybe a little bit about the context of when that last happened.
Yeah, so there is exactly what you just said, is that I don't think I'm going to win a sprint, right? I'm like the most slow twitch guy you've ever met, and I don't think I've ever won a sprint ever. But having said that, I'm not really hurting. So in particular, I've been riding a mountain bike, and that's just because I like riding mountain bikes more than anything else. On the mountain bike, it has certain advantages and certain disadvantages. And it seems to be really important that you stick to the guy's wheel, because once the speed goes above a certain threshold, say 15 miles an hour, I've got too much of my body in the wind. The wind resistance grows exponentially. And so I'm at a huge disadvantage there. So it's important that I stick to wheels. And I guess so. What's going through my mind is I'm thinking, oh, well, this doesn't really make any difference, does it? Third, first, who really cares? You know, I'm still going to get the podium picture. Ivy's going to get to go on the podium. I'm going to get my money back. I'm going to get a little bit of cash back. So I'll pay for the cost of the entry fee. Like, what difference does it really make anyway, whether I come first or third? So maybe there's a little bit of that too.
Okay, so here's the first observation about this, is that we all start, well, not all of us, most of us start, right? If you're going to pin on a number, meaning that you're competitive and most of us start a race with a competitor mindset. And a competitor mindset is that you're out there to do as well as you can. You're going to duke it out. You're going to focus on your effort and be prepared to work hard and compete against other people. And then what happens throughout a race is that we often drift into a participant mindset. And a participant mindset is, oh, I just want to finish. I'm out here. You switch to this kind of weird rationalization of finding gratitude. Oh, look around. I'm so happy to be out here. If I can't win, it doesn't matter. And in actual fact, you may be telling yourself a lie as well, because you are kind of pissed off and you wish you'd done something different. So that shift during a race from being a competitor to a participant is one of those that is that I think is the plagues many athletes, right? So the issue is, why do we do that? Why do we switch to a participant mindset when we started off as a competitor? Now, some athletes start only as a participant. So these people might not be thinking that they are, they might not be that, or they self-describe themselves as not being competitive. In other words, they're on the line. I just want to have fun. I don't care how I do. So I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about you start off with a competitive mindset and you shift. So there's probably a couple of things that are going on. One is that undoubtedly it's related to effort and fatigue. And so as you get more and more tired, and we liken this, we give this analogy as well in our book about the chimp brain and our professor brain. So we've got this emotional reacting machine in our brain that's also telling us that things are hurting and that you're in danger of potentially having some catastrophic heart failure, or that your lungs are going to explode, or that you're going to be embarrassed or humiliated and not deliver. So you've got this voice inside your head that often starts as the competitor mindset. So this is really, I still believe that the heart of a competitive mindset really stems from your chimp, right? Prove yourself, a competency, and to enjoy the sort of the head-to-head competition. But as things kind of go along, your kind of chimp kind of, I think, turns inward a little bit and starts to think, well, this is, I do like all those things. I do want to win. I do want to be a competitive, but now this is, at what cost is this coming? And so you start to think about, well, this is really hurting. And as your energy systems deplete and you're starting to question the pros and cons of actually trying to keep pushing. And then you start to rationalize this with your professor brain. So now your professor brain joins in the party. And really, the professor and the chimp kind of gang up on you. They're really saying, well, listen, you can do it another time. You know, this is only a small race. It's just an evening series and you don't have to worry. It wasn't one of your A races anyway. And, you know, you're rationalizing why it's good to throw the towel in there and then. And I think that fundamentally it represents an inability to stay in that competitive mindset despite it hurting. So this is what we often talk about as resilience training or adversity training. When things hurt or feel sucky, how do I persist anyway? And how do I focus on things that are going to keep me pushing? So it's really a shift in mindset that happens. And for you, it might happen in the latter part of a race when there's other people around you. But I would urge or certainly recommend that we focus on what does it take to stay in that competitive mindset for you? So if you think of when you're at your most, feeling your most competitive with your racing hat on, you might describe emotions of, well, I'm kind of, it's not anger, but it's sort of like ready for it, up for the challenge. I'm ready to hurt. I want to prove myself in relation to other people. How do I stay in that versus shrink back into not today, it hurts, I'm happy with the complacent self? So in that competitive mindset, we all often say, listen, the two things that you can control in a race and the only two things that you can control are your effort and your attitude. And your effort and your attitude are really going to be your sort of go-to things to focus on when you feel that shift coming back to being a participant. So for athletes, it's saying, first off, you need to recognize when you're sliding into participant mode, right, versus competitor mode. And for some, it might be just seeing, and I'll talk about a good example in triathlon, is that if you're a consistent podium contender or a top five athlete and you see you consistently start to count, you're looking at people's calves because your age group is written on your calf. So you can see where you're placing or how people are passing you. If it's a question of I get one, two, three people going by me, that might be my little cue or trigger to slip back into participant mindset. For other people, it might be, for you, it might be, well, I'm not going to beat them in a sprint and I don't want to hurt much more than I'm hurting now. Therefore, you've made this decision that it's probably no point anymore and I'm going to shift back. So it's recognizing what your cues are that slip you back into a participant mindset. So I would have athletes like list down, okay, talk to me about the competitive you, the emotions that you have, the thoughts that are going through your head. And then let's do the same for the participant you. And sometimes you have to draw on races where you designed to go in as a participant. If I run the Turkey Trot 5K to feed the homeless, my mental mindset going into that event is going to be quite different than if I am in a competitive 10K or I'm in this race series and I'm trying to stay in the top five overall and so on. So what sort of characteristics you have? And so you recognize those two identities that you have in yourself, right? And what you're trying to do is to sensitize yourself to knowing when that slide is happening, when you're sliding back. And we want to try and bring it back to things that keep us focused on attributes of the competitive you. And I'd ask you now to talk about the races where you felt as though that hasn't happened, where you have summoned the energy to get on those other two riders or to find it in you to drag out the, squeeze the sponge, the last bit in you. What does it feel like? What do you remember feeling and what are the thoughts that go through your head at that time?
I mean, I feel like the only time that I really confidently feel like that is when I'm leading a race and I know that there's not a good chance that somebody's going to claw me back, which to be fair, has not happened many times in my cycling career. I think the rest of the time I do what you've just described. I slip into participant mode. So I said that it's easier if I stick on the guy's wheel in front of me. Then I'm surprised at how easy it is. You know, I'm like, shit, we're three laps in here and I'm sticking with this group and it's actually not that much work. You know, this is pretty good. And then I think that might be the trigger. That's like, oh, okay, now we're on a Sunday afternoon group ride and I can just hang out here. And then the hammer goes down and I'm then in participant mode and the other two guys ride away and I'm left right. Just doing a Sunday ride.
Okay, so if sometimes it's about your perception of effort, and that's often a lot of the time what drives the slide into participant mindset is that I'm already feeling like this and I don't want it to go on much longer because it hurts. I'm not sure if we talked about this last time about this central governor model of exertion.
I am familiar with it before I listened to your book. So I've interviewed Tim Noakes, so I am familiar with it, but I don't think you mentioned it last time.
Yeah, so I mean, it is a fairly contentious concept. Scientifically, it's contentious, but there are enough sort of breadcrumbs around in the studies to suggest there's probably something in it. And the general tenet is that the way that your brain interprets feelings of effort perception is not simply just interpreting direct feedback from blood chemistry, stretch receptors, muscle fibers and heart and so on, and ventilation. Where there's some filtering that goes on in the brain before it emerges in your head as a thought or a feeling about how a certain intensity feels, right? There's many studies to show why this may be happening, or sorry, how this might be happening. So one thing that we think, part of our brain called the anterior cingulate cortex that processes effort perception, well, one of the functions of it is called anticipatory regulation, a really fancy way of saying, before I'm going to tell you, brain, how this feels, I need to know some information. And one piece of information I need to know is how much longer do I have to endure this for? And we know this, we can manipulate this in scientific studies by doing deceit studies, right? By telling you, okay, you do this for this long, and we actually make them do it for longer, or vice versa. And we see and we look at how people's perception of effort changes, or pain in the context of those sorts of studies. And what we find is that when your brain is denied information about how long you've still got to go, curious things happen to your perception of effort. In other words, mostly, effort feels harder. So most athletes might know this as if you're going out on a ride or a run, or and you don't know where you're going, or you're going with someone else. Oh, just trust me, it's a loop. Well, how long are we going? And where's the loop? Oh, just run. And just running or just riding, it makes it hard to know how to meter out your effort. And likewise, when you're in a race and you know that you've got 3 laps still to go, or 6 miles, whatever it is, your brain is using that information to tell you how the effort feels for you. So if you knew that you had only 1 lap to go, you could tolerate a bit more and push a bit more than if you've got 3 laps or 5 laps or 7 laps or so on. And we're not trying to kind of overrule some basic biology here and saying, you know, you're going to deliberately lie to yourself that you're pretending you've only got 1 lap to go. But what we can do is segment the effort that we've got so that it does feel a little bit easier. And so segmenting is simply taking sort of 1 lap at a time, right? And then making that decision to throw in the towel, or the decision that you, the go, no go decision that you have to make in sport if you're hanging on for dear life, or you're trying to say how much longer can I hold this for, is that you don't try and think of the entire race that you've got to go. You just think of, okay, I'm going to just hold this here and now for the next lap. And then after the next lap, I'll make a decision about whether it's just not going to do it for me, or I'm going to hold it to the climb. And then I'm going to make a decision. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to segment that effort up into much smaller chunks. And what you're really doing is you're manipulating that anticipatory regulation mechanism so that you're thinking, okay, the perception of effort will be more tolerable because I know that I'm going to make a decision after a shorter time versus a longer time and so on. So for you in that circumstance, it would be, the starting point would be, okay, the next time you're in that situation and you're settling for third, what we want you to do, Chris, is actually to go as though that you're on your last lap. It doesn't matter if you end up settling after with 2 laps to go, you can probably still hold your position, but let's go ride that third lap with 3 to go as though that this is for you, your last lap. And actual fact, when people have got the lap wrong, you know, we've always seen examples of people who bolt out and they think they've won it and they hear a bell and everyone's got a lap to go, except you didn't know it. That we know that we can summon that effort or energy when we need to. And even if you end up blowing, because rarely are we going to cross the line totally exhausted. That's the other sort of finding of the central governor theory, is that even though we've given it all, we've usually still got something left to keep going. So you're not completely emptying the tank, but you are playing with the fact that your brain likes things in small, manageable chunks. So it would be, okay, ride the first lap, see how you feel, ride the second lap. And you might completely decide after that third lap that, you know what, I'm done, I'm just going to coast in for third. But we're trying to increment your way into the point where you can eventually sustain it for the rest of the race.
That makes a lot of sense and is very helpful. When I looked at the lap times on Strava afterwards, that my last lap was actually my second fastest lap. So it wasn't like I didn't have it in the tank.
Right. And
I think you're right. When that move goes, if I think about that as being the race for the finish line, knowing they're going to settle down, like this is just a move. And in fact, in the case where I did get spat off, what had happened is one of the guys fumbled, like bobbled, nearly fell over. And then he sprinted back onto the group and left me behind, right? That was kind of how the break happened. So I need to think of that moment as being like the sprint for the line. Wouldn't you agree?
Right. Absolutely. That's one strategy. And the other interesting thing here is that we get into the murky waters of self-sabotage. So self-sabotage is partly when we sort of bail out. We call in our book, we call it a shit quit versus a legit quit, when you kind of sort of soft pedal or throw in the towel. And the self-sabotage part is when you're not doing it in a way that you're describing it, meaning that I just don't know, I'm just happy for third. Self-sabotage is when you're kind of actively doing something or finding a way out so you don't have to explain why that you, or you've got a reason for why you didn't stick with those two riders or why you didn't push through to the end. And so the self-sabotage part is a really interesting psychologically. So one of the things that might be at the root of it is this notion of proving competence and worth, right? So, and I'll invent a fictitious rider. So I don't want to make this about you. Say we've got a rider who is in a group and we've got 10 miles to go, whether it's lapped or not, and you're in a small group. And it starts to get harder and harder. The pace is going up. And then that decision, maybe a gap might open on the back of the group and you have to close it. And then there's a point where you think, oh, fuck it, this is too much. But you know, because you're thinking this in the moment, that when I finish, I'll be pissed at myself. The fact that I didn't just give it that extra effort. Because when we look back on our races, hindsight, we seem to forget how hard it feels at the time component, right? Because most people look back on their races and think that they could have gone harder than they actually have gone, because they forget the saliency of how effort affects our brain is very short-lived. So when the race is over, you forget how much it hurts. This is why people keep registering for races over and over again, because that part soon sort of, we have that effort amnesia. But what's happening with competence and worth is that, say that you're self-sabotaging in the sense that you convince yourself that this really wasn't the race that you needed to go hard at, and you come up with some fictitious or invented reason why it makes good sense to not go with the group, right? Other than I just couldn't, I didn't have it in me. And for some athletes, that might be as simple as saying, there might be something as saying, I started to feel as though I was cramping, and they may not have been cramping or whatever. Some people say, oh, I was getting a flat, or I dropped my chain and whatever. So you start to do this. So why do people do that? Well, one theory anyway, is that when you give it everything, when you lay everything on the line and it's still not enough, meaning that you pushed as hard as you can and you still came third. For some people, that threat to your sense of worth and competence is far too great. In other words, I don't want to have my ego be exposed to such the point that I've got no other reasons other than I wasn't good enough as the reason it didn't happen, right? So I need to have some other way of explaining why it wasn't good enough. And this isn't true of all people. This is mainly true of people who have a very strong need to demonstrate competence and worth, and hyper-competitive people can be like that, and so on. So that may be another reason, right? So if I lay everything on the line and it's still not enough, what does that say about me? I lack the talent, I lack the ability, I lack the whatever. Because that is far too traumatic for some people's egos. You then kind of concoct explanations about why it wasn't meant to be that day or why this happened. So you never let yourself, your competence, be truly vulnerable to saying that it didn't happen. The cruelty of this is that when you do that, when you do lay everything on the line and it's still not enough, is that rarely does the world end. And rarely, well, not rarely does the world end. The world never ends. But rarely do you get the humiliation, embarrassment, or sense of inadequacy or ridicule that you're probably anticipating, or the expectations that you've concocted in your own head that people have for you or you have for yourself. They often don't materialize. In other words, people aren't saying, well, I thought you were a lot better than that. You could only get third in the sprint. You know, people are far too self-absorbed about their own races and stuff to worry about that. So the competency worth challenge, and this is comes back to the Carol Dweck's issue of a fixed mindset versus a growth mindset as well, that fixed mindset people, where they see their competence and worth as being fixed. In other words, it can be identified if I'm ever going to put myself in a position where it can truly be known. And if that's in danger of it shown to be anything other than a winning, talented, attractive, smart person, I'm going to avoid those sorts of situations.
Okay. So this is still on my reading list, Mindset, The New Psychology of Success by Carol Dweck. I need to read
exactly.
That.
Yes. Okay.
This is why I love you, Simon. It's like you've given me an operating manual for my brain. It's very, very exciting to me. So yeah, the Brave Athlete, you got to go get the Audible version. It's quite brilliant. I've still got one more race to go at least. So I'll let you know now that I know that. You've just kind of given me a lot of good information there. So we'll see how that goes.
Okay, right. Let us know.
There's a couple of things that I found troubling during the book. And I don't know whether you agree with me or not. Okay, so go back 5 years for me. And I had the basic premise of your book is like, are you having feelings you don't want? If so, then maybe you should read this book, right? You'd say that's
thoughts and feelings. Yeah,
thoughts and feelings. And so 5 years ago, I was having all kinds of thoughts and feelings I didn't want. It was all the time. It was constant. And part of it was being really, really foggy and not being able to think clearly at all. You know, I don't really feel like the professor brain was working particularly well. And then what I did was I fixed my biology. And I would argue that biology defines behavior. And so what I worry about when I listen to the Brave Athlete is that somebody may have something biologically wrong with them, an infection or some kind of undiagnosed inflammation. And that could be leading to the thoughts and feelings that they don't want. And so you're kind of screwing around with them in a way that may be slightly helpful, but really what they need to do is look inside and see what's going on with the biology.
Is that a question? Was it a statement? I think I agree with you. I mean, it's not just that behaviors are biologically based. Thoughts and feelings at the neuronal level, I mean, they are essentially just synaptic connections and impulses, so electrical activity. So yes, that's absolutely true. I think that what we would take the stance is that for most people who are ostensibly healthy, meaning that there isn't some underlying pathology or some underlying issue that's driving these other sensations, then sure. But for most athletes, that isn't the case, statistically speaking. But absolutely. And I think this is a criticism leveled at psychology in general, right? And one of the reasons that I'm a big advocate of sports psychologists having sports science training, meaning not just coming straight through psychology and only ever having psychology, because if all you have is a hammer, everything is a nail. So if I'm going to start to say that an athlete who comes to us and they always collapse midway through the run of a triathlon, and we talk about, you know, resilience training and attitude and effort and mantras and thumb tapping and segmenting, and in actual fact, they're just not eating and drinking enough. So it's a nutritional problem, or they've made such terrible tactical errors that they are leaving themselves, you know, woefully, you know, so you have to have a little bit of a holistic view about this sort of stuff. And to be honest, when you talk to athletes, you often can get a sense, and athletes, I think, are pretty good at this as well, of knowing when something is, they detect that it is something a little bit deeper than just simply having thoughts and feelings related to how I want to perform or having expectations or competition anxiety and so on. Not all the time, because again, and take the issue of depression. Depression rears its ugly head in athletes or having it in many different ways, of which no amount of mental training can actually help you remedy some of those things if there's a biological or biochemical imbalance. So absolutely. But I think that not wishing to sort of say this is a one size fits all and it works for everybody, but for the majority of athletes who aren't dealing, I should say the majority of athletes are not dealing with these sort of chronic pathological or biochemical imbalances. They're dealing with things that they just want to be the best that they can be on the day, and they feel a little bit paralyzed by doubt, anxiety, fear, or so on.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about psychiatrists? So that's why I'm kind of dancing around this issue here that you mentioned a couple of times in the book. If this is looking more serious and maybe it's something we could put a proper diagnosis on, maybe you need to go and see a psychiatrist. And psychiatrists terrify me because they are the only doctor that don't look inside their patient, which seems to me, I mean, of course, there are exceptions, right? Daniel Amen, Kelly Brogan, there are exceptions to every or to this particular rule. But that to me, you know, sending somebody to a psychiatrist who has anorexia, for example, that's just terrifying. Like, I think you need to look inside at that point, not just talk to someone about it.
When we talk about getting clinical help, we're not talking only about psychiatry. We're talking about clinical psychologists. You know, there's a whole host of helping professions around how someone's head works, not just psychiatry. But yeah, psychiatry can be quite intimidating to many people. But let's not forget the psychiatrists are also MDs. So of
they
all
could do a proper job. It's just they tend not to, right?
Right. Well, but you could also argue that clinical psychologists are more likely to make those decisions because they've got the least training compared to psychiatrists, or less trained than a psychiatrist in terms of underlying physiology and so on. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of one of these things where are the tools of psychological help, therapeutic tools, are they sufficient or necessary to be able to help someone get out what they're dealing with? And that ultimately comes down to the skills of a therapist and knowing how that you know the limits of your own knowledge, when you, what you're looking for. And sports psychologists are trained in symptoms of referral, so they know, they might not know how to help someone with an eating disorder, but they know the symptoms and when to refer people. And all of the professions are like that in their training, whether it's a clinical psychologist, master's level counselors, and psychiatrists.
Now, when you talked about exercise addiction, which is a fascinating topic that you tackle in quite great depth in the book, I feel like I was also using exercise as symptom management, right? I felt terrible apart from when I'd been on the bike for an hour and was properly warmed up. And then I started to feel pretty decent. That was the one time when I actually felt pretty good. And I wonder how many athletes there are out there that are using exercise as a crutch, right? They're using it for symptom management. And again, so it comes back to that thing. You're seeing a lot of exercise addiction, but is it because of some underlying biological thing that needs to be addressed?
But that's also addressed in folks who study exercise dependency. For example, we talk about primary and secondary dependence. So primary dependence is when it's the actual activity itself that's giving you the feelings that you want or how, but secondary dependence is when it's really symptom management of some underlying thing. So this is what we often see for athletes who have eating disorders or disordered eating, that we often see that secondary exercise dependence goes alongside that because it's a way to control and manage feelings about your own body. So secondary exercise dependence is probably more common, not probably, it is more common than primary dependence. And the underlying of more than that just going on. And so this comes back to this compartmental model, I guess, of how we think about this stuff versus a holistic model. And I'm a big believer in holistic approaches, that we're looking at the moment we start to reduce things to single emotions or single experiences without looking at the bigger picture, we run the risk of either missing much of what's causing it or that we end up treating something that actually isn't the problem to begin with.
Yeah. And again, with discussion of managing injury, you know, like you discuss all these things, like all these problems that athletes have when they get injured. And you describe me to a T, you know, like 5 years ago, I was the guy that just completely lost my shit. I can remember shouting at Julie, just go home and leave me here, you know, when I broke my leg or something. Now I've busted things since then. After I fixed my gut, I crashed on a trail. I'm like, look at my hand and it's pointing in the wrong direction. I'm like, oh shit, I've broken my wrist. I best go and get that plate. And it was like none of those things. It was completely different. And I swear it must be something to do with fixing the underlying biology rather than having talked to someone and having them like, tell me why I feel in the way that I do.
Yeah, but I think that's also a fairly sort of deterministic model, right, of why athletes think and feel the way they do. If we're reducing everything to biology, it's not denying that there's biological roots to these things, but it's like on a practical level, what do you actually do about it, right? So I don't think we would disagree on that, but I think that you are probably more in the minority than the majority in terms of the root causes of things being. And again, it might not just be when you had this stuff cleared up or you fixed your diet and suddenly your approach to life took a left turn. But those moments are quite rare for people, I think. And having, you know, because you'd already recognized that something wasn't right with your diet and you were suffering a whole host of other physical symptoms as well. It wasn't just that you were sort of, why do I get so annoyed when I get injured?
Mm-hmm. Well, here's what I think now. I think everything is important, right? Like it's no one single thing. It's not just the diet. It's not just your response to stress. It's everything is important. And this is why I think it's so important to include your services in our elite performance program. So that's the announcement. Simon's now going to be working with every single athlete that joins our program, is because I think that you're going to be able to get the same or maybe even better results in less time, because behavior change is the most important topic. And I think that you're going to get it faster than I can as a computer scientist.
It's not me versus you or who the race to fix people. It's saying, listen, we need to have a multifaceted approach to this, or the approach has to be multifaceted. So we have to look at this thing from multiple angles, of which one of which is understanding the very much the experiential part of an athlete's journey through ill health and coming back to health. as well as how do I improve my performance through better use of my head. But the same can go for, you know, we've got dietary interventions, we have sort of stuff addressing thoughts and feelings, and then we've also got stuff about being having a better tactical knowledge of what you're doing, and biomechanical insights, and so on. So I think all of these things are coming at it from multiple angles is going to make people better athletes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm really hoping that you're going to help us all find our purpose, because we all understand the importance of that now. But as a practical matter, it is extremely difficult. So do you think you're going to be able to help people with finding their purpose?
That question is unfair to ask. Am I supposed to? Yeah. Well, let's go back 10,000 years. I know. I mean, and this is also, and not to be a negative Nora about this, or a Pollyanna, as I should say in America, is that this is also somewhat of a contentious issue as well about the role of purpose finding in life and how we seek it and whether we can seek it and for whom is that important to do. And this comes back to maybe this is a whole other debate about the positive psychology movement in general, about the sorts of activities and the sorts of things that we're doing and at what cost that comes. I know we've talked a little bit about that in the past. But yeah, I mean, I think that having some bigger sense of purpose and meaning for most people is not a bad thing. The issue is if you're going to be frustrated and self-critical or guilty when you're struggling to find it, and if it can be found, what does that mean? You know, I don't think it's all, if we could all find purpose in life, all of our troubles would suddenly, you know, evaporate.
Well, it goes back to the statement I made earlier, which is that everything matters, right? It's not just about one single thing.
No, that's true. Right.
Maybe this is a good time to segue then into, thank you so much, by the way. I'm just like throwing turds at you here and you're being such a good sport. Maybe this is a good point to segue into talking about positive psychology, because you made an off the cuff remark in some conversation that we had online somewhere that I won't read it to you. But anyway, it led to the recommendation that I read Bright-Sided, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America by Barbara Ehrenreich, am I pronouncing
yes.
that correctly?
Yeah. Ehrenreich.
Yeah, and it was a fantastic book. It's so funny and well written, and her vocabulary is absolutely amazing. And I'd highly recommend that book to anyone. But Simon, tell me, why don't we start by saying, what's good about positive psychology?
Well, the first thing is to say, you know, what is positive psychology?
Okay, that's a better question.
And again, I don't know if I have the answer to this, because a lot of the folks who use the word positive psychology also use it in very different contexts. General positive psychology is the lay understanding we see in the self-help literature, and that kind of, has been focused on this notion that, you know, we should be looking for what is happiness and how do we find it, right? I mean, it's since been extended to more existential stuff like finding meaning in life and that kind of stuff. But in essence, the criticisms of the psychological field of positive psychology, which are, you know, trained psychologists doing psychological research in elements of positive psychology, and Martin Seligman and Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, the other two guys who are mainly doing a lot of this research, has actually received quite a lot of criticism. And it's not so much because of what they're focusing on, but there's lots of criticisms, one of which is the context in which we are looking at things like purpose and meaning in life, and for whom is that important and why? And is this very much a sort of, it's so culturally bound that maybe for people who aren't struggling in socioeconomic circumstances, poverty, ill health, all the other things that make these higher order things a luxury to pursue purpose. But what is it we're actually trying to get at? And so I think that the criticism, like the Barbara Ehrenreich book that we talked about, is to a certain extent, it's the straw man criticism, right? So it's the motivational speakers that are brought into businesses to say, how do we focus on the positive? How do we stay optimistic? How do we not get dragged down by people's negativity? And that sort of stuff is largely a theoretical, a pseudoscientific. And I agree that many of those, there's a dark underbelly of that movement of motivational psychology in the workplace in general. And some of the criticisms have been because it's been largely used to kind of cover up, hide, or generally distract the workforce from things like corporate layoffs and terrible working conditions and people having very little work-life balance. So there's that side. The other side of positive psychology is, now, is it as a legitimate psychological discipline to study about optimism, for example, and its role on mental health or other or physical health outcomes? And that is legitimate. It's not quite as straightforward as saying, oh, it's either all good or all bad. But I think there are debates on both sides. But in general, I would say there are elements that we should be looking and I'm excited by. studying how optimism and how positive attitudes and how facets of our mindset can actually contribute to our health. But at the same time, not using it as this kind of panacea. You know, all we need to do is think positively, because there's lots of people in circumstances that no amount of positive thinking really is going to help, because they're in circumstances that are obviously the root cause, have fundamental like structural problems with the conditions under which people live and so on. So that's my sort of 10,000 foot view of it.
When I read Barbara's book, I started to think that maybe some of the problems with positive psychology were similar to, it was almost like a religion, right? It's like this unquestioning belief in positivity, even where there's none to be found, can be very dangerous. And it reminded me of the radical candor concept to a certain extent, which is that, you know, unless you're straight with me, how can I possibly improve? And maybe the same is true with positive psychology, is unless you're able to see both sides of the coin and make a proper evaluation based on the available evidence, you know, how can we ever get better if all we ever think is, you know, the glass is half full?
Yeah, I mean, a radical candor, I think, is slightly different, because that model in general was proposed in a very specific context, which was in leadership and management. And it's devoted primarily to how do you give feedback that is accurate, but in a way that's compassionate. But positive psychology, that one of the challenges of it is that we're almost made to feel guilty if we're unable to expunge or exorcise negativity from our lives, right?
Complaining is a better word.
Yeah. Or whining, right? Or complaining. And there's some evidence that being, whether it's pessimistic or complaining or whining or looking for the negatives, can actually be very helpful to life. So I wouldn't say that it's the same thing or the same context as radical candor. But you're right. In the pop psychology self-help world, it has got this kind of cult-like following. And I do find it mildly humorous that its popularity, primarily in the US, because, you know, North American culture in general is very much about positivity and optimism and living in the greatest country in the world and all the other hyperbole that gets thrown at our kind of lives here. But at the same time, I think that you've got to look at the consumption of antidepressants and where we find ourselves in the world's rankings of nations' happiness. The US is nowhere near the top. So there is some sort of paradox going on. On the one hand, we've got this positive drive to be, find meaning and grateful and joy. But at the same time, we're also, our lives are telling us and things and our consumption of these pharmaceuticals are telling us that clearly that's not the case.
Yeah, it's been one of those things as a British person living in the US. I can't say I was terribly aware of the cult, I would say, of positive psychology or positive thinking. And then once you're aware of it, it's like Toyota Prius syndrome, right? You see it everywhere. It's in apps, it's in adverts, it's everywhere. And I don't know, I find that, was I just not looking before, or is it somehow subversive, you know, where I'm just like being affected with it by it and not even noticing it? Because that's quite scary.
Well, I think it has certainly increased in the last sort of 5 to 10 years, you know, and who knows, maybe that's in response to, if we feel as though we're inundated with negative news in whatever sphere of life that you want, whether it's health or politics or whatever, finances, then we're going to search for something to be positive about, right? And is that an artifact of the human condition as well? I don't know. Maybe that we're seeing it more recently, partly because people have found that they can commodify it. They can sell programs, and now it's getting legitimate scientific scrutiny. And that maybe scientizes it a little bit, which gives it more credibility. You've only got to spend time in industry to know that this is rife. You know, look at the rise in executive coaches, the rise in motivational speakers in corporations. So it's clearly on the rise, but the issue is why? And does that come at a cost?
Interesting. Well, I think this is a great place to wrap up. Okay, to recap, the three books that we talked about in this interview were Bright Sided, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America by Barbara Ehrenreich, Mindset, The New Psychology of Success by Carol Dweck, and finally, The Brave Athlete, Calm the Fuck Down and Rise to the Occasion by my guest today, Dr. Simon Marshall, and his amazing wife, Leslie Patterson. I will link to all of these in the show notes for this episode. Of course, Simon's now going to be part of our Elite Performance Program. I'm super excited about that. Simon, do you have any room in your coaching practice? Because we don't create training programs for athletes. We just fix the biology for the most part.
Yeah, we do. So we coach mainly endurance athletes. So these are runners, cyclists, swimmers, and triathletes, and ultra distance athletes as well. both physical coaching and mental coaching. So yes, they can find us at braveheartcoach.com. That's our kind of coaching website, or you can obviously contact me through MBT as well. So yes, we do. But like all things, coaching is a relationship versus just a prescription. So the fit is essential. So when we talk to athletes for the first time, yes, we want to try and find a way to working together, but often that may not be the case simply because time, or there's just some other issue to do with, you feel as though the philosophy of training isn't a match and so on. So we want to have athletes find the right coaches for them, whether it's us or not, but we can certainly have be part of that discussion.
That's a really great point. And Julie was telling me just the same. Julie's my wife, and she's been doing the free starter sessions. You can book those from the front page of our website. And she was telling me just yesterday, actually, that she spoke to someone and said, you're just not ready for our program. You know, like, here's some things that you might want to think about and come back and see it maybe a year before you're ready, you know? So, I mean, I'm not sure that she said a whole year to the person who was on the phone, but that's what she said to me, you know? So navigator is a good word, right? I'm just going to help you find the way rather than try to force you into something that maybe that's not right for you.
Yeah.
Awesome. Was there anything else you'd want people to know about, Simon?
No, other than enjoy reading our book or listening to our book. And I'm really excited to work with more MBT folks, because it's lovely to get to know athletes, not just the ones that we speak to in our regular practice who are, you know, just struggling to cope with those thoughts and feelings, but also those that are struggling with health issues and see how to make sense of their thinking as they navigate their way back to better health.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Simon. I really appreciate you.
No problem, Chris. Thanks a lot, buddy.
Cheers.